So watch for local bookstores in a year or so. Let's go to the first question. And of course, as always, keep them short. No autobiographies. Here you go.
Good evening. I'd love to hear three or four or five aspects from your perspective that Putin and Trump are very similar, but also very dissimilar.
Mm-hmm. Good question.
That is a good question. You know, we have to remember that what we know about Putin is something that's evolved. He has evolved as a leader over a 17-year period. You know, he came in as an almost complete unknown. He made some sort of clumsy foreign policy gaffes early in his career, but he has become steadily more knowledgeable and more poised as time has gone on. You know, I've seen him in this kind of forum. I've seen him sitting in an armchair at various conferences and so forth many times. And I'm here to tell you that this is a charismatic guy. This is a guy who projects enormous authority. You know, he's a comparatively small man. He's about 5'6" or so. When you see him standing among his entourage, he's always the smallest person in the group. But he's a guy who fills up a lot of space. You know, you notice if you ever see him in one of these things, he sits like this. He man spreads. He puts his arm around it like this. He owns the stage. You know, so he's now a guy who's learned a great deal from his 17 years in power. He has also steadily consolidated his own position. So in 2012, as you may recall, there was a lot of interest in who ran the Kremlin, who were the centers of power in the Kremlin. And in fact, you may remember the New York Times would do these graphics. You know, it would show photographs, little circular photographs of the Russian leadership. And, you know, part of them were the security service people, some of them were the liberal economists, you know, and there were lines drawn back and forth. And it was all very impressive, and we all paid a lot of attention to it. Well, nobody's doing that anymore, and the reason for that is that Putin has little by little gotten rid of a lot of his former cronies, and he's replaced them with young technocrats who've never known anything but Putin in power and have no loyalties anywhere else. You know, so he has become a vastly more powerful figure over that time. You know, so we have this guy who's crafty, who's a quick study, who's personally charismatic, and you know, who has a great deal of experience in power, and who has become the pencil point of Russian policy on every single subject. Then we have Mr. Trump, you know, whose career we have all followed for a long time, especially in this neck of the woods. You know, but I mean, his career is that of a businessman, a marketer, a branding guy, a guy who was able to make a name that he was then able to sell, a guy who's always prided himself on being able to do deals. And, you know, he has not had the policy experience, nor does he seem to have the policy interest that could make him into the kind of force that Putin has made himself into. You know, so I think we're in dangerous territory, and I would like to see more institutional support for a coherent American foreign policy, which would include using the resources of our State Department, using the resources of the Pentagon, and not concentrating power among a coterie of people who have very little experience.
Vladimir.
Yeah, hi, I'm Vladimir, I'm an undergraduate, and I had a question about Alexei Navalny. I know that in Russia, opposition leaders have a habit of being jailed on charges of corruption or whatever it might be. Navalny, however, in the European Court of Justice was found to be not guilty. I'm wondering, is Navalny getting to be too big to jail? Is he too famous? What do you think is going to be the future of Navalny going forward towards the 2018 presidential elections?
Well, as you probably know, you know, Navalny has been tried and convicted on what are universally, I mean, at least what, for instance, the European Court of Justice regarded as trumped up charges and what they actually called a ludicrous judicial process. But nevertheless, he has been convicted. And one of the things that that means is that he can't legally run for president of Russia. And he is the leading potential opposition candidate. The other thing is that in one of these trials, he was tried along with his brother for having allegedly committed embezzlement in a business deal that they were involved in. His brother was thrown into jail. And so in a way, there's a hostage to the government, to the justice system, this brother in jail. Navalny has effectively been blocked from running for political office. His brother is being held essentially as a hostage. The Russian government up until now has always wanted to show that there was an opposition, whether it was viable or not. They wanted to show that there was an opposition and that they, you know, it is possible to do that. There are, in fact, systemic opposition political parties in the Duma right now that are part of the Kremlin system and will always vote the Kremlin line. But there is, you know, one of the things about Russia's democracy is that it has always tried to preserve some sort of trapping of opposition. And I think Navalny is their guy, and the reason that he's allowed to go free, at least so far, is that, you know, he is still the symbol that somehow we have some sort of open process in Russia. That may prove not to be true in the future, and Navalny has always had to live with the possibility that he could be jailed at any time. You know, like so many people who are about to be arrested in Russia, he does keep a bag, you know, of toiletries and things like that ready to go.
Wow. Yes.
Do you view Putin's ultimate vision for Russia as being something relatively modest, basic economic prosperity, the lifting of sanctions, prestige and respect in the international arena? Or on the other hand, do you think it's rather more ambitious than that, in a sense becoming the nation, a hegemon, as it were, on par with, say, the current United States or previous empires?
That was well put. And I think that, in fact, his vision is bigger than that. You know, he does, I think he's looking for the restoration of the Soviet and the Russian Imperial Empire. He'd like all that territory to be Russian. He believes that it is Russian. He said many times that the neighboring countries are not countries at all. He said this of the Baltic states. He said this of Ukraine. And he said it of Kazakhstan, as a matter of fact. Mm-hmm. So these are all former Soviet countries that he regards as being essentially part of Russia's orbit, at the very least, if not part of Russia's imperial territory. So there is that. I mean, the other thing is restoration of the economy, and I think there's a certain amount of magical thinking that goes on in the Kremlin. The idea that if sanctions were dismissed and oil prices rose even slightly, they could be back in a position where they could sort of restore their economy, build up their foreign reserves, and then start attracting foreign investment again. So there is that as well. But, I think it's a mentality. Putin has a mentality that you don't want to back into a corner unless you're willing to take really decisive action against him.
Thank you so much for coming. I'm an undergraduate at Brown as well. We've seen over the past few years an expansion of Russia's aggression, as you said. We're seeing this particularly in the cyber arena. We're seeing this in cyber incursions in Georgia. We're seeing it in the allegations of interference in election processes. And we also see it in investment in Russia's cyber apparatus as a form of conflict. Where do you see this growing, and who do you think could be the possible next target of Putin's cyber arm?
Well, I certainly, you know, I certainly think that, you know, and I'm just taking the word of the United States intelligence agencies, that they expect that, you know, they see that the Russians as having experienced success, maybe far beyond their original plans, in fact. You know, my guess is that the sort of Russian cyber attacks on the United States may have been a lot more modest in scope, or at least modest in ambition, and that they may have had a sort of windfall success that they didn't fully expect. You know, so people from the intelligence agencies are saying, you know, building on that success, we can expect to see more and probably more sophisticated cyber attacks. You know, and it's not just a question of propaganda or hacking or, you know, trying to influence the political process. There's, you know, far greater dangers to our infrastructure. You know, there was a Russian exploit last year. Remember, it shut down a power plant in Western Ukraine. You know, they've shown that they have that ability. You know, so I think that we can consider ourselves a target and that we should take defensive action.
Thank you.
Interesting question. Professor Haidt. Mm-hmm.
So it's not hard to see that President Trump is close to a certified sociopath. So how do you see President Putin taking advantage of that in the past and in the future? I read an article in Vanity Fair last night about one of Trump's, Putin's closest advisors who had written a story and a pseudonym about the ways in which they manipulated the Ukraine, et cetera, through false information and everything like that. So the question is really, how do you see the future in terms of the tendencies of our current U.S. president and the capabilities of the FSB and their agenda?
You know, it seems to me that the Trump administration is now besieged by these various accusations and connections and so forth, and they seem to have drawn in their horns quite a bit as far as activities with Russia, and that may happen for the foreseeable future. What's more, the Russian attitude towards Trump seems to have changed. You know, they were absolutely gleeful when Trump was elected, and you know, we know that there were communications among Kremlin officials patting themselves on the back for having achieved, for having predicted or having said that this was a possibility when most people in the West didn't believe it was true. I think that, you know, if I'm going to sit here and do something that I could never do when I was a reporter, and that's speculate about what's going to happen.
That's what we do here.
Yeah, the various arenas. You know, I think in the arena of Ukraine, for instance, I think that we're aiming at we'll find ourselves in a frozen conflict, not unlike what we have in Georgia, Abkhazia, for instance, right now. I don't think that Putin domestically can afford to withdraw from eastern Ukraine. He certainly can't politically. It would be political suicide for him to give up Crimea. Mm-hmm. And I think that we're going to find that there's not enough interest on the part of the United States or the West to defend Ukraine's interests, unfortunately. I mean, that's something that we really should have given a lot more support and a lot more attention to Ukraine. But that's not in the cards right now. So I think what we're going to find ourselves with is one of these awful frozen conflicts. Costly to the United States, costly to Ukraine, and it's going to make it very difficult for Ukraine to achieve its ideal or its ambition of joining the European Union anytime soon. I think the same thing is going to happen in Syria. I think that Russia has invested a great deal of prestige in supporting Bashar al-Assad. I think they're going to continue to do that. You know, they've shown that they're willing to commit war crimes to support al-Assad. And, you know, I think that's something that, you know, what they've had is, you know, the old Colin Powell pottery barn rule that if you, you break it, it's yours. You break it, you buy it. They have become invested in it, and Syria is now Russia's problem in a way that it was not America's problem. And that means that he's going to have to continue to invest time and resources in Syria, and he's going to probably have to force a situation where Assad claims most of Western Syria, the mountain regions, the Alawite regions, and he's going to have to leave a sort of frozen conflict line between the eastern parts of the city of the country that will be the responsibility of the various neighbor countries that are involved in this. One of the things that I've noticed about Syria lately is that Russia seems to be getting militarily exhausted there. You recall that, you know, the when Assad's armies seized the city of Palmyra, you know, that was a great coup and something that was widely celebrated in Russia. You know, they were tremendously proud of the fact that it was with Russian support that Assad was able to reclaim that sort of iconic city. Mm-hmm. Well, there was very little publicity when later on it fell back into the hands of ISIS. Mm-hmm. And it's only very recently that they were able to recover it again. That says to me that Russia doesn't have the military force, may have the military force to capture ground, doesn't have the military force to hold it. You know, that's a very exhausting, very personnel intensive business, as we found in Iraq. You know, so I think that Putin is in the same shape that we were and are in Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yes.
Speaking of, so to speak, frozen conflicts, over the last several decades, as climate change has affected conditions in the Arctic, we've seen more and more kind of pushing of buttons in the region, especially on the Russian front, kind of claiming territory and sending expeditions under the ice and above. I suppose I was interested in hearing your perspective. Like, do you think as sea ice continues to recede in the coming years, is there a political will in Russia to kind of see how far they can go and kind of push their luck into the Arctic? And do you think that, perhaps with your perspective from Alaska, like, do you think the United States will have the will or the capability to kind of push back and prevent Russia from having somewhat of a free hand in the Arctic?
No, I think there is the political will in Russia. And I think, you know, that they certainly would like to dominate the Arctic with as much territory as they can possibly claim. And as you said, I mean, that goes right up to the North Pole where they dropped that titanium Russian flag. There's also a great deal of capacity in Russia that other Arctic nations do not have. They have the best fleet of icebreakers, including nuclear-powered icebreakers. And they have an enormous amount of engineering expertise when it comes to working in the Arctic. So they are a formidable player in the Arctic right now. But at the same time, I think that the right now, at least, you know, the open water passage through northern Russia is, it's premature to say that there really is a lot to be done there. Because in fact, even at the best, that passage is only open for a very short window in the summertime. The weather there is terrible. So that if you're planning to take one of those big cruise ships through the Russian Arctic passage, bring your slicker. I mean, it could be potentially pretty awful. You know, and what's more, if you're in a vessel in the Arctic and you get caught in one of these terrible storms, you get frozen in, like the Franklin expedition, there's nobody's going to be able to come and rescue you either. You know, so the environmental challenges are really formidable. Russia's, big interest in the Arctic, of course, is in resource extraction. And, you know, at the very beginning, at least, it's all about offshore oil. But with oil prices dropping to the level that they have, with fracking being, such a big deal in the United States, with nations like Iran bringing more and more oil production online, I don't think Arctic oil development is going to be a very serious issue for anybody in the immediate future anyway. Canada is the country that probably has the most to lose in terms of territory in the Arctic. The United States has rather less, but I mean we have resources to protect in the on the North Slope and that kind of thing. So I think, you know, we need to get in there, and we need to have a presence in the Arctic, and we need to be doing research there, for sure.
Interesting. Yeah, thank you. Go ahead.
Hey, thank you so much for being here today. I was going to ask about Syria, and you kind of beat me to the punch a little bit. But as a follow-up, do you think Russia's situation in Syria is going to change at all as a result of the chemical weapons use that happened recently, and the increased calls for actions in the United States that followed?
I'm not sure I fully understand your question. I'm sorry.
You're
a little bad.
My bad. I'm sorry. Do you think Russia's position in Syria is going to change at all as a result of the chemical weapons use that happened earlier this week?
No. I mean, because Russia has always denied that those attacks came from the Syrian government. Recently, in the UN recently, we saw them trying to blame the rebels. The rebels somehow have stores of sarin gas that we didn't know about and that they, for some reason, never used before. And I think that's a crock. I think that whole take, that whole Russian story built around rebels having gas is absolutely untrue. I think it's propaganda. I think it was the Syrian government that did that. But Putin has shown that he will support Assad through any atrocity or any war crime that the man can think of doing. The Russians are the ones who have bombed hospitals in Syria. Unfortunately, they have a whataboutism case where we bombed a hospital as well. But I think that the strategy on the part of the Assad government and on a part of Russia is to attack these civilian centers, drive people out of them, take them over if it means leveling cities like Aleppo, and assuring that Assad stays in control. So I don't think that a little thing like 200 people being killed by chemical weapons is going to deter anybody in Russia.
Thank you.
Corey, this has been fascinating. Just one last question. There's a lot of students here who aspire to a life like yours, to a life of journalism, a life of writing. So to get back to John's questions, any advice?
Yeah, the only thing about my career is I wish I had started it sooner. I wish I didn't start it in college. I basically did. After I left grad school, I did start to write for a little free paper in Chicago called the Chicago Reader.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and so that was, I was dipping my toes into it at that point. But I'm really sorry that I missed the years immediately after college when I could have been doing reporting somewhere, having a lot of fun doing it, and had less at stake than I did later on in my career where I felt like I had to succeed.
All right, get to work, everybody. Corey, thank you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much.